But you are seen outside in nature anytime. We loved your phenology notes. You can text those in to 218-326-1234 or email us. Where would they text? Email phenology notes. I should know this. Jay Latimer.
Yeah, you could do jlatimer@kxc.org. There we go. We love hearing from you. And, you know, Dan had sent in that story about his mom, the librarian. That's because we're gathering the stories from you about what libraries mean to you. As our news team is out there covering the cuts that are happening in our local regions and what that means to the community, to have to families, to people living in our community that need libraries. And so we're gathering those stories this week. You can text us at 218-326-1234. More news is coming up next. It's 8:01.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Israel and Hamas have agreed to the first phase of a ceasefire. It's supposed to go into effect later today. Israel is to free thousands of Palestinian prisoners and detainees. Hamas is to release all 20 living hostages in days. NPR's Kerry Khan reports Israelis are celebrating.
In a downtown Tel Aviv plaza where families and supporters of hostages held in Gaza have gathered for more than 2 years of the war, crowds flooded in to celebrate.
The United States of America!
Many are praising President Trump. One man waving huge American and Israeli flags called Trump the eighth wonder of the world. Another person dressed as Trump posed for selfies with many. Dani Miran, the father of Omri, a hostage in Gaza, said he is on top of the clouds. It's a supreme feeling. I feel like I'm about to see my son any moment now, like he is reborn, he says. Kerry Khan, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
A federal judge will hear arguments today about whether President Trump can deploy National Guard troops in Illinois. Trump says he'll use them to fight crime, but Illinois officials object and sued him. They say there's no national emergency and the troops are not needed. Federal immigration agents are still operating in the Chicago area. Protesters, including Leonardo Jimenez, gathered in Chicago last night.
It's just terrifying, you know, who can be targeted? You know, I don't want to have to carry my passport around.
Separately, a federal appeals court today will take up the issue of Trump's deployment of National Guard troops to Oregon. The appeals court panel ruled yesterday that Trump can keep the National Guard troops from Oregon and Texas under his federal control. But at this moment, he cannot deploy them on the streets of Portland, Oregon. Japanese automaker Honda is relying more on Canada instead of the United States to make cars that Honda can export overseas. The automaker is trying to avoid U.S. tariffs. Stephen Bisaha of the Gulf States Newsroom has more.
Honda's still building cars in the U.S., but those factories are now focusing on making vehicles for Americans rather than for exports. Lamar Whitaker is the head of Honda's Alabama plant, and he said that's allowing the car company to still meet demands.
Without passing on the cost of tariffs to our customers.
David Fernandez runs the Mazda Toyota plant in Alabama and said several of their models are setting sales records. But the industry is still dealing with uncertainty.
Supply chain for at least our products is pretty stable right now. But it's just the lack of visibility to know what's going to happen in the future.
Meaning they don't know if President Donald Trump will make sudden changes in trade policy like he's done before. For NPR News, I'm Stephen Bisaha in Huntsville, Alabama.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. This year's Nobel Literature Prize has been awarded to Hungarian novelist Laszlo Krasznahorkai. He's known for books such as The Melancholy of Resistance. One of the recipients of this year's MacArthur Genius Grants is a scientist who researches street drugs. Nabrun Dasgupta helped develop programs to reduce fatal overdoses. NPR's Brian Mann has more.
Dasgupta, a researcher at the University of North Carolina, was one of the first scientists to detect a hopeful drop in fatal overdoses in the U.S. He also developed a system to help spot deadly new drugs being sold on the streets, and he's helped distribute huge amounts of naloxone, the medication that reverses opioid overdoses. Dasgupta's work is being honored at a time when the Trump administration is hoping to defund harm reduction efforts like Dasgupta's that offer health care to people still using drugs. Dasgupta described the MacArthur Genius Grant as validation.
I don't think the universe could send a clearer signal that I should keep going in the direction we're going in.
As Gupta says, there's more work to be done. Tens of thousands of people in the U.S. still die from overdoses every year. Brian Mann, NPR News.
The MacArthur Foundation is a financial supporter of NPR. Researchers have discovered the remains of the world's oldest shoe, and in a very strange place. The shoe fragment was from a sandal, and it's 675 years old. The researchers found it in the nest of an endangered vulture in Spain. The researchers say the nest is old, too, and that prior vultures probably used the shoe fragment to help build it. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
You've been listening to headlines from Morning Edition from National Public Radio here on People Powered Radio, KAXE. Thanks for listening this morning. We receive support from Hot Tubs of Northern Minnesota on Middle School Avenue in Bemidji, offering hot tubs, pool tables, saunas, and more. Learn more online at hottubsmn.com. The Grand Rapids Area Community Foundation announces the Itasca Area 100 Plus Women Who Care Giving Circle Monday, October 13th at Timberlake Lodge. Registration starts at 5 o'clock, program at 5:30. Attendees each contribute $100, and nonprofits are nominated to receive the collective donation. Find more information and register on Facebook. And the Happy Dancing Turtle is offering Family Nature Play Days, a chance for children ages 2 to 7 and their families to explore nature at the Hunt Utilities Resilient Living Campus in Pine River. Dates are Friday, October 10th from 10 to 11:30, Tuesday, October 14th from 3:30 to 5 p.m. Find more information at happydancingturtle.org.
Coming up, we're going to be talking with Steve Grove, publisher of the Minnesota Star Tribune. We're featuring some new books this hour, and then at 9 o'clock, we bring you Headwaters with DJ Dang.
this is Taylor Ray and new music from her album The Void. It's her second release. That song is Telluride featuring Sierra Hull. You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on KAXE People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Support comes from Edge Center Arts and Center for the Arts in Big Fork, presenting Sketches of Minnesota, a civic community comedy tour, Saturday, October 11th. Doors open at 5, dinner at 6. Open to all with registration required. Info at edgecenterarts.org.
That's Kari Headland. I'm Heidi Holton.
We all have a story to tell, where we came from, what came next, where we are now. Place is important to our stories, especially if you've changed where you are. Moving from Silicon Valley to Minnesota and the Midwest, for example, can have a lasting impact on your life.
Steve Grove is the CEO and publisher of the Minnesota Star Tribune. He has a new memoir out that chronicles change both personally and in career. It's called How I Found Myself in the Midwest, a memoir of reinvention. Steve Grove joins us now. Good morning, Steve. Thanks for being here.
Morning, Heidi. Morning, Kari. How are you?
Good.
We're doing well. It's finally fall in Minnesota, Steve, as you know.
I know. Believe it or not.
So let's start at the beginning with you, Steve. Where are you from?
I grew up in Northfield, home of cows, colleges, and contentment.
And cereal.
Cereal, yeah.
And cereal. Lovely, yeah, and lovely smells of cereal.
I know. We woke up to that smell every morning. Better that than manure, I suppose.
Yeah.
No, it was a great place to grow up. But like a lot of Minnesotans, I guess, maybe growing up, I thought there's probably something outside the state worth exploring. So when I graduated way back in 96, I guess, I left the state, went to college in California, spent some time abroad. And the book, as you mentioned, is kind of a boomerang story of how I found my way back.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about, Silicon Valley, and then what brought you back to Minnesota? Because the first time I started seeing your name was, of course, when you joined the administration of Governor Walz.
Yeah. Well, I really enjoyed living in Silicon Valley. It's obviously a really innovative place, and spent most of my career in tech, working at YouTube and Google, kind of in the early days of YouTube, and then into Google in some of its more mature years, trying to navigate a unique moment for that company and in technology in general and how it affected politics and news. But my wife, Mary, and I, who also worked at Google, met, and after a long journey with IVF, we're able to have two twins and felt very fortunate about that. And then, like a lot of Minnesotans, started wondering maybe we would actually move back to Minnesota. Now, Mary was from San Diego, so for her, it wasn't moving back, I should say. But for both of us, it was a chance to kind of reboot our lives and try something different. And we thought a lot about where we wanted to raise our kids. And so Minnesota was interesting to us. And, you know, Mary got a job at a venture capital firm focused on investing in startups outside the coasts, which we were both really passionate about because not all the innovation's happening on the coast of our country. And then I came back to Minnesota still working with Google, but when the governor was running, and I'd known him a little bit from his very first run when he was a teacher running for Congress, I started helping out the campaign a little bit. And when he won, ended up becoming the jobs commissioner, which was a kind of a total reinvention, if you will, going from tech to state government. But really, really enjoyed the chance to lead the Department of Employment and Economic Development through what ended up being a pretty trying 4 years in our state. And learned a lot. And the book kind of focuses on that journey and a lot of other aspects of coming back home after being gone for a long time.
So were your, fellow colleagues in Silicon Valley, was that shift to government work surprising? Were people, wondering, what are you doing? These are very opposite sort of cultures, which you talk about in the book.
They are. Yeah, Google, the sort of hotbed of innovation, doesn't exactly scream government bureaucracy. But, you know, so yeah, I think the people were surprised. I found more people were surprisingly encouraging about it. I think a lot of people at companies like that, you know, you get to work in this innovative place. And of course, the private sector has all kinds of opportunity. But I think a lot of people do sometimes think, well, how could I give back? What would a more purpose-driven existence look like? And government is one way to do that. So I ended up getting a lot of good advice from people on it. And a lot of people who I felt like at least were cheering me on, which was helpful because it's a hard thing to do to switch careers. And all of your listeners and the two of you too, I'm sure, have had moments of reinvention and trying new things that you need kind of help from others. But I really enjoyed it. I think, you know, I wanted to be really careful that I didn't come into government saying, hey, we should run this place just like Google. You know, you don't want to be kind of a cartoonish, you know, this should just exist as the private sector exists kind of leader. But there were things about working at Google that I was able to bring to Deed that I thought my colleagues really appreciated and wanted to see. There's actually a lot of innovation in government. I was really surprised and emboldened by how many people at the agency wanted to try new things, but just didn't have the lane or the empowerment to do it. And of course, governments are more risk-averse cultures, in some ways for good reasons, but in some ways to their detriment. So trying to bring some of that innovative mindset to Deed was a big part of the journey for me. And again, I was just really impressed by how many of my new colleagues were just as innovative as the Googlers I worked with, but just lived in a different, more constrained environment.
Well, in one of the passages in your book, you talk specifically about that, where within the culture of work anyway, you came in with the idea that you weren't going to just change everything, but actually there was desire from those who were there for you to change some of these things. Like, even down to like being able to wear jeans.
The dress code. Yeah. It always comes back to the dress code. Yeah. It was funny. Our dress code at Deed was so old when I arrived that it still included a prohibition against wearing Zubas, which I think
a very era specific.
Yeah. I think it was like, around 2000, perhaps, when we had a different governor at the time.
Oh my God.
But yeah. There's some low-hanging fruit. We're like, okay, sure, you can wear Zubas. Not if you're meeting with a client, but, in the building. So, there was. And I think there was also an appetite to try new things. I think in government today, it's very common for people to say they trust government less. They think government can't get things done. And, part of it is the government doesn't try new things or operate in the way that companies we do really like and enjoy operate. So we created an innovation lab inside of Deed that gave people a chance to use some basic principles of like human-centered design and a customer-focused approach to try to improve everything from grant administration to how we help the state invest in new startup companies. And yeah, you're right. We got a lot of momentum in that because people wanted to find new ways to do things. Of course, when the pandemic hit, when George Floyd was murdered, when crisis arrived, that forces innovation in ways that normal times don't. And so as challenging as those times were, it did allow us to kind of rewrite the playbook for how we did our work. And of course, then if you don't do that, you're in trouble. So I think sometimes crisis gives you the biggest opportunity to do something new.
You talked about, in government that it's kind of a calling, and the people that work there, it's a way to give back. What did you see in your staff during those crisis times and how they did their work?
Well, they showed up every day trying to get things right for Minnesota. And the team that probably exemplified that the most is our unemployment insurance team. You'll remember we lost 420,000 jobs in one day in April of 2020 when we had to shut down the economy. And for that moment to hit the state so quickly and to suddenly have to get a lot of money out the door meant, the bureaucracy that had already operated an award-winning program had to think of entirely new ways to get the dollars out the door and to make sure the system didn't crash. You remember, in many states, people were standing in line with paper applications around the block just to try to get their application in and get the dollars they needed to put food on the table via a program they probably barely even knew existed because they'd never had to think about unemployment insurance. So, we had a team that found ways to get all of our tech onto the cloud so that it could bear a heavier weight online. We found new ways to get applications online. We translated all of the materials into several different languages we'd never translated it into before. And, just did a lot of outreach and education. Part of this was just making sure people understood what was going on. And you might remember those daily press conferences at 2 p.m. where the governor and Jim Elkham and myself and others were sharing with the state kind of how this was all working and trying to over-communicate, at a time when so much was uncertain. And yeah, my colleagues in government at that time did all kinds of really innovative things to make sure we got dollars out the door. And in fact, Minnesota was the first state in the country to get all three of those federal unemployment insurance extension programs out the door. So I was pretty proud of that, proud of the team. And, there's all kinds of things we got wrong during the pandemic, too. So I'm not here to say to just cheerlead Minnesota. Like, there were ups and downs. But just getting those dollars out the door itself was kind of a baseline win that I think I'm really, really proud of the team for.
We're talking with Steve Grove about his new memoir that's out, How I Found Myself in the Midwest, a memoir of reinvention. And then you reinvent yourself again. Let's talk about the Star Tribune, the change of the name. How did this, tell us about your interest in it and how it came to be.
Yeah, I had never planned to be a newspaper publisher, if I'm honest with you. Few people do, especially in the year 2025. It's a challenging industry for reasons you well know as much as anyone. But there's something unique happening here in Minnesota. We have an owner in Glenn Taylor who really cares about the future of the Strip. He wanted to reinvest in it. He wanted an outsider, someone who wasn't dripping in ink, if you will, but came from, you know, a tech environment. And all those things together made it, to me, kind of an attractive puzzle to try to solve. You know, there's not really a leading model for local news in the country that's really operating with the kind of stability that, say, the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times is operating at. So it was kind of a shot to try something big and also to do something meaningful. You know, as KXE shows, when you have a good local news organization in your community, you just get better outcomes, right? More people vote, more people pay attention, more people donate to charity. This isn't just anecdote. This is actually, surveys show this to be true. And so the Strib, as you know, the biggest newsroom in the entire Midwest, over 200 journalists, has, you know, outsized impact when it comes to some of those outcomes. But there's no inevitability that the Strib's going to be around forever. There just isn't. You know, we lose 20% of our print subscribers year over year. You know, we are facing, you know, existential headwinds to the business, as you are too. So it was an interesting challenge to tackle. And I felt like, you know, no guarantee of success for sure. But if you get it right, and you could actually build the leading model for local news in the country, that would be, that'd be pretty good for the state. So it's been a good journey, about 2.5 years in, and we're making some headway.
Well, and back to, I mean, even though these are different avenues in a professional degree, it absolutely still ties into which we are experiencing as well. What you earlier said was crisis allows for innovation. And so, you know, this crisis of a newspaper is obviously a different crisis for you to navigate, but it is still, you know, figuring out what is this future and how do we navigate into this future and still have a space for it. And in a strange way, I just attended a conference about the radio and I came away feeling actually really positive about the future of what our place could be in the media landscape of 2025. And I've got to imagine that there's still some of that within the newspaper too, of like people are looking for that tangible and real local voice, you know?
They are. You find that trust in media gets stronger the more local you get, right? I mean, the listeners of KXE, I'm sure, trust you more than they trust any national outlet. It's just more proximate. It's more real. They might know you personally, right? They might be your neighbors. Mm-hmm. Same is true for the Strib. And becoming the Minnesota Star Tribune has been an opportunity for us to hire reporters outside of the Twin Cities. We really feel like we have a shot at being a statewide organization, not replacing hyper-local news organizations that cover the community in the depth that you do, but hopefully lifting them up as well and telling stories the whole state can pay attention to. Our traffic data shows us that people in the Twin Cities want to read about northern Minnesota, and they do read about northern Minnesota. And they show that people in northern Minnesota want to read about Mankato and Rochester. And so this is a state that has kind of a unique statewide identity. Minnesota pride is actually a real thing. The surveys will show you that Minnesota and Michigan are the two states with the highest state pride of any state in the country. So you know, you've got that kind of Minnesota exceptionalism that doesn't hurt. We got our paradoxes too. We know that. But yeah, I think the Strip's got a shot at it. And you're right that local news in particular, more so than national news, has a shot at holding us together just by the very virtue of having fact-based information we can rely on and trust. There's communities without KXEs whose primary source of news is a Facebook group somebody created. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the state of affairs we're in. We've lost in this last 10 years 75% of the local journalists in this country. So what you're doing, what we're trying to do is fighting those trends. But I'd give Minnesota a good shot. There's all kinds of challenges, but this is a state where we feel like if any state's going to figure it out, why not us?
So, Steve, how do you balance, you know, the need to get subscribers, keep the business going with a trusted model of journalism and really investing, too, in the ethics of news?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I think the social media era of news, if you will, seemed to have surfaced a lesson that many people took, which was that you got to produce more cat videos and, you know, clickable content to survive in media today. And actually, this era is showing that's not true. That the things that actually convert subscribers for us are deeper investigative stories. They're, you know, really useful hyper-local high school sports coverage. It's the review of the concert or the museum that people want to read, and they know that takes time to get right. And if you're going to trust the content you're getting, you probably got to pay for it, because you have real journalists with real notebooks and real pencils and, you know, real shoe leather out there doing the work. So I think that, in fact, this isn't sort of the clickbaity era of media anymore. I do think that people don't consider they should pay for news or donate to news. You face this, I'm sure, all the time. I'm sure many of your listeners right now enjoy KXE but might not have donated before. They should, by the way. They absolutely should. And we say the same thing to the Strip, right? You just a free press comes at real cost. You gotta be out there with real journalism that costs money. So we're trying to make that argument and remind folks. I think the good news is that the content that converts isn't the silly stuff, because you can get that for free. It's the deeper stuff. And we just launched, for example, our first standalone investigative team in over a decade in our state. And that's an investment we're making in doing the kind of journalism that you really want to pay for.
It seems to me in keeping up on the reading the Star Tribune that you're also making a point to show how journalism works, how a newspaper folks do their jobs, like how they got this information, especially recently with the kind of just laying out how it came to be that some of the you probably know what I'm talking about. You're gonna have better words
behind
for
transparency.
Yes, behind the scenes of the news that came in about what was being text messaged from the federal government. Covering that. That seems to be a very important thing as well as just actually the news.
You got to do it. My newsroom gets tired of me saying, and I don't run the newsroom, by the way, I'm the publisher, not the editor, but I'm always asking them, give us more behind the scenes. We want to show our customers, you know, all the great work you're doing. And they do a great job of this, but we probably do even more. Yeah, it's just a reminder. It's also kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. Like, how did this actually happen? How did you get the story? And it does, I think, remind people that it takes a lot of work to get it right. And, you know, journalists today, and especially in stories like that, and in stories that are, you know, controversial or at least touch on topics that are dicey, face unprecedented threats to their security and to their work. And so a big part of what we're trying to do is build a culture and a community of security at our organization where journalists feel empowered to go out and tell the tough stories. And that takes a certain kind of resolve and backbone that I really can't say enough about for our reporters who are out there like you, you know, digging up stories that people need to hear and telling the truth.
So, Steve, I know that we want to be respectful of your time here, but one more thing that is a pretty evident theme for you is just the importance of the Midwest and why it's not just flyover country. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, it's funny. The book title is How I Found Myself in the Midwest, but the working title is actually Fly Over No More. Publisher thought that was a little hokey, so I'm fine with that. We didn't go that direction. But it gives you a sense of what was on my mind, you know? I really do think this isn't just flyover country. Having left for a long, long time and then come back, I think it's fly to country. And I don't think that's just hyperbole. You know, this week, just 2 days ago, we held our first ever North Star Summit here in the Twin Cities. It was an ideas festival. We brought together leaders from across the country and here in Minnesota to tackle for one very packed day at the Walker Arts Center a whole host of issues that are facing the country through a Midwestern lens. And I think a Midwestern sensibility to this moment that we're in, regardless of your political background, is so important. And we hope we can build, not only at the Strib, but at events like the North Star Summit, kind of a beacon for the Midwest, for truth and for the future, and a place of ideas, a place where the First Amendment is in fact celebrated, not derided, a place where journalism is supported, not ridiculed. And it's a hard way forward right now, given the kind of national mood. But man, when you get down to the local level, there's a lot more hope. And I do think the Midwest itself has a lot more hope for us all right now. And I'm bullish on our state. It's punched above its weight for a long time. We've got all kinds of challenges. But I think if the Strib succeeds, Minnesota will succeed even more. So that's the journey we're on.
Has your wife become a Minnesotan? Has she fit in?
Does she have the pride? Does she have a tattoo yet of Minnesota?
She's not a tattoo person, but no, I think in some ways she's become even more Minnesotan than me. She invests in companies here that are changing the world and is bringing a lot of connections between Silicon Valley and Minnesota to fruition as well. And yeah, she's from San Diego. I myself don't love the cold winters here. I guess some people do. It's not my jam, but you know, we've learned to get through the winters and enjoy it. And, you know, I think there's a kind of her thesis at Bread and Butter Ventures, her venture firm, is that the kind of the corporate density and the business density here and the success of the economy are great training grounds for startups. And so why not leverage a Minnesota advantage when it comes to new companies rather than considering it, you know, kind of flyover country? So that's been neat to see. And yeah, we're making our way.
That's Steve Grove. His new memoir is out, How I Found Myself in the Midwest, a memoir of reinvention. Find more at stevegrove.com. Thank you so much for your time today, Steve. Really appreciate that.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Coming up next, we've got local news with the Up North Report, then Adriana Trajani and her new novel.
We receive support from Minnesota Power, an elite company envisioning a carbon-free future through their Energy Forward strategy. More at mnpower.com/energyforward.
And thanks to Bemidji Brewing, they announced the return of their espresso porter filled with roasted coffee flavor. Now on tap and in cans throughout the region, Bemidji Beer, nice catch.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with the Up North Report. Authorities have arrested the man who escaped from custody 2 weeks ago at the Northeast Regional Correction Center in Saginaw. The St. Louis County Sheriff's Office reported 40-year-old Michael Todd Hart was found inside a residence in Cohasset on Tuesday morning. Law enforcement executed a search warrant after learning of Hart's whereabouts. Hart had escaped custody on September 23rd, and authorities said they believed he would be headed to the Iron Range, where he has friends and associates. A 29-year-old woman was also placed under arrest for aiding an offender. Hart and the woman were transported to the Itasca County Jail pending arraignment for new charges. Members of the Minnesota State Senate made a quick stop at Brainerd Public Utilities on Wednesday as part of a bonding tour of northeastern Minnesota. Brainerd city officials pitched three projects they are hoping to help fund with state money. The biggest ask is for $28 million, or about half the cost of a new water treatment facility. The facility would mitigate copper corrosion throughout the distribution system, which is currently above the federal drinking water standard. Mayor Dave Bedeau notes that without the funding, residents' water bills could increase from about $40 a month on average to nearly $70. He says the projected costs for the new facility have risen substantially.
We're not concerned about the people that can pay for it. We're concerned about the people that can't pay for it. The single mothers that are on a limited income, or the grandmothers or elderly that have a fixed income.
Senators Karen Housley, Sandy Pappas, and Ann Johnson Stewart are members of the Capital Investment Committee. Pappas asked about whether a sales tax paid for not only by residents but also visitors to the tourist area could help. But a local sales tax is already in place in Brainerd, and it pays down the debt the city took on for its wastewater facility. Pappas offered officials a reality check on the $28 million price tag.
I mean, our bonding bills are pretty restricted, and there's so many needs in these communities. All this stuff's aging at the same time.
Bedeau also shared information on two smaller projects: the expansion of the Cuyuna Lake State Trail and a pedestrian bridge over a busy part of Highway 210. The senators and staff then loaded the bus for their next stops in Floodwood, then Grand Rapids, Keewatin, Hibbing, and Ely. The tour continues Thursday along the North Shore. Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison was in Bemidji on Tuesday night for a community forum. Larissa Donovan was there and has more.
Ellison began the forum going over some recent actions his office has taken on a federal level. He says ever since President Donald Trump took office, he has been taking the administration to court over issues like the executive order purporting to end birthright citizenship, tariffs, and data privacy. He says his office has helped facilitate the movement of $2 billion in federal funds to Minnesota after funding freezes, and that he is committed to protecting the rights of all Minnesotans, regardless of race or gender identity.
It is simply because I don't like bullies, and I don't like scapegoats, and I believe in liberty and justice for all, and all means all.
30 people gathered in the Chapel of United Methodist for the forum, asking about how the office is responding to the National Guard being federalized in American cities, ICE agents conducting massed raids, and more. Beltrami County Historical Society Executive Director Emily Thabes spoke to the federal funding cuts proposed to the Institute of Museum and Library Services.
Institutions depend on MLS for funding of digitization projects, education programming, and in some cases, operations.
The proposed federal cuts compound with local funding woes, as the local museum is also expecting to lose all of its funding from Beltrami County in 2026. Ellison will host another community forum in Brainerd on October 27th. Larissa Donovan, KAXE News.
A webinar series aims to support woodland owners and forestry professionals as they respond to the summer storm damage in the Bemidji area. The series is hosted by the DNR in partnership with the Minnesota Forestry Association. The first webinar is 4 to 5:30 p.m. Monday. Presenters include DNR Forest Health Specialist Megan O'Neill, who will discuss common pests and diseases, and Potlatch Forester Brian Bignall, who will give a forest industry perspective on the blowdown. Visit KAXE.org for more information. That's it for the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
836. Thanks for tuning in. It's People Powered KAXE. Lots of folks listening in, sending us messages this morning. We sure appreciate it. Our question of the week is about libraries and what they mean to you, or if you have a little memory of your favorite librarian, text it our way, 218-326-1234.
Support for KAXE comes from Great Lakes Aquarium, celebrating 25 years of bringing aquatic life and learning to Duluth, Minnesota, with ocean and freshwater-focused exhibits for visitors of all ages. Hours and tickets at glaquarium.org.
Increasing clouds throughout the day. There's a slight chance of rain with highs 63 to 67. Breezy south winds up to 25 miles an hour. Cloudy tonight with lows in the mid to upper 40s. And tomorrow, Friday, sunny with highs 58 to 62 degrees.
Native Defense presents the second annual Our Voices Restored community event this Saturday from 11 to 3 at the Beaux Arts Ballroom on the campus of Bemidji State University. There will be panel discussions, local music, a community meal, and resource table, free and open to all. You read an event earlier today, Heidi, about lutefisk and lefse.
Yeah.
And I was just reminded of my lefse emergency that happened last year. Do you remember this?
I do. We had Amy Thielen on the horn. And
because my mom's lefse iron broke.
And people came forward to help you.
Yeah, they did. Like, it was, I just remember saying the words, "We have a lefse emergency." And it was like, man, listeners came through. That was amazing.
Yeah. So fun. Amy Thielen was on with us yesterday.
Yeah, she was.
Stopped by the studios and, you know, helped Andrew and I move through our Sloppy Joe arguments and, you know, and then on to.
So are you gonna try, would you try cheese on the Sloppy Joe? That was the big deal.
No.
No, still not even trying.
I mean, if someone handed it to me and it's a, you know, it's in the church basement or it's at someone's graduation, of course. I'm polite, you know, but I don't know. There's something about it. I think I'm not. I think the majority is cheese is fine.
I will say, because we've done, we do cheese at our house sometimes, cheese, pickles, and mustard.
Okay.
On the Sloppy Joe. But I will say sometimes you don't even really taste the cheese. So okay. Maybe it's not right. Even necessary.
Hope he's not listening today. That Andrew, we don't want to make. But also Amy was talking about like what she's making with her garden and how large the cabbage has been. And she's making apple cider too and all this stuff. So we love hearing what's the fall been like for you. So many people like staying up way too late.
Processing.
Canning. Yeah, processing and canning and doing all this stuff.
Someone I was just talking to was talking about their apple tree and they were like, the apples are the size of grapefruits because they just have not, yeah. There wasn't a frost until this week.
Yeah, we just finally picked all the, we have different kinds of apples. We finally just picked the Honeycrisp and still have some more probably cider making ahead of us, which, dang, it's a lot. So I wish we were done. We've had three of them so far.
It's kind of like maple syruping, you know, sometimes it's like, oh, okay, still,
but it's great. Very happy. Like the middle of winter when we can pull out some fresh apple cider out of the freezer. Wow.
Yeah.
Make a apple cider slush.
That sounds fantastic. Mm-hmm. Hey, we got a text in from Kathy in Grand Rapids after our conversation with Steve Grove. She said, love, love, loved your conversation with Steve Grove. Love their story today on the Pines restaurant. Love the deeper balanced news Megan and team are providing our community. You all are incredible, are doing incredible work in the midst of challenging times. Adam and I will be investing more in KAXE. Thank you for all you do. Your work is valued and so important. Talk about bringing the tears to the eyes, Kathy.
Yeah.
Gosh, feels so good to hear that. Thank you so much. And then we also just heard from a listener about libraries. Our question of the week is about libraries and your memories of them. She said, Sherry and I just returned from Spain, Portugal, and Tangiers, Morocco. An African verb goes, When an old person dies, a library burns down. Free speech and access to knowledge is a basic concept of democracy. Hank Helmquist. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Hank, for that. We are asking for your memories of libraries. You can text us 218-326-1234.
Of all the places I've done and been, it's the mountains that call me and show me how to fall in love again, in love again, in love again. I'm tied to the peaks and the crags, like the root of the tallest tree.
That is a new song from Al Nickel called Mountain Song. Here on the Thursday morning show, I'm Kari Hedlund here with Heidi Holton. We are going to be talking books in just a moment here. First, I want to thank Dragonfly Coffee for their support of programming located in Central Square Mall in Grand Rapids, featuring a scratch bakery and offering espresso, bubble tea, and more. Empowering inclusion and community through employment, special orders available, and more at drinkdragonfly.com.
This is People Powered KAXE. We love talking books anytime, but especially Thursday mornings. Kari and I enjoy that. New novel that's out that we both read is called The View from Lake Como. I'm so excited to welcome back Adriana Trajani. Not only do we get to talk about the book, which we normally do, the author's here. And first and foremost, welcome back to the Iron Range of Minnesota, Adriana.
Oh, come on, Heidi. Come on, Kari. I'm home. I'm home.
We feel it.
Home on the range, girls. Home on the range. I know we don't say girls anymore. No, but, you know,
yeah.
Who cares?
So for those who don't know, Adriana, can you talk about your connection to Northern Minnesota?
Yes, I can. I'm very proud of it. From Crosby to the Iron Range. Well, my mother was born in Chisholm. She's a twin. And my grandparents were Italian immigrants. My grandfather, Carlo Bonicelli, and on the range they say Bonicelli. Carlo Bonicelli emigrated early. He came over and worked on the range. Then he went back to Italy. Then he came back. And when he came back to earn his citizenship, he was a kid. He decided to enlist in the army for World War I because many immigrants earned their citizenship in that fashion at that time. And he had a shoe shop in Chisholm called the Progressive Shoe Shop. And my grandmother, Lucia Spada Bonicelli, worked in the back, and she was a seamstress. So she did all that kind of alterations from the department store in town. And, oh my God, they were working class, fabulous, happy. And then my grandfather died at the age of 39, leaving behind three children because he was gassed in the trenches of France during World War I. And my grandmother married him. They met in Hoboken. They're from villages 5 miles apart in the Italian Alps. And I will tell you, ladies, that when I come home to Minnesota, to my mother's home, I feel that Minnesota is the Italy of America. The pristine lakes, the gorgeous rolling green fields, the people. I love Minnesota. And I have cousins in Crosby now. And we, of course, then go up to the Iron Range and visit. And I go to the library, which has not changed since I was a child, when I would visit during the summers. It you know, go to Valentini's, ravioli that's homemade, like your mother made it, okay? It's an adventure. I love everything around the mining industry and stories of the great Vita Panikvar. I could keep going. And then, of course, I always slip through Hibbing and take a couple of snaps on the steps of the great Bob Dylan's home.
Yeah. You know, Adriana, everything you said there is like you're describing your entire books, all of the novels you have ever written. Because I believe I've read every single one of your books. And, you know, you wrote one about shoes. It's been about people who immigrate but then go back to Italy and come back. Libraries, you just said, like
the strong sense of home, even if you didn't grow up there, but that tie, the familial tie to a place.
So every week we have a question of the week on KXC, and we kind of, it's a way to connect us with stories. And, the small towns here are facing cuts for libraries and hours and our news.
It is unconscionable.
I know.
In a country of this wealth. It is unconscionable.
Yeah.
And, Minnesota has a long tradition of supporting libraries. You had Joan Mondale. They called her Joan of Arts. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Oberstar from up on the range. You get Ken Martin, who's now running the Democratic Party. And this isn't political, folks. This is moral. And as my mother used to say things to me like, you're never worse for having read a book. And the book banning is a kind of a BS operation by five people, half of which have sketchy backgrounds, who are just causing trouble. If a book is inappropriate for a child, you do not expose the child to the book. It's really simple.
Just like movies, just like shows.
It's common sense. Child rearing, common sense educating. Our educators, if we turn to them who are trained in the art of teaching, they come fully loaded with all this intelligence to help us, guide us. I leaned on the teachers when my kid was young, like I leaned on my mother, you know? So let's rejigger our thinking on this. And, I had the opportunity to meet Mrs. Walls, your first lady, Minnesota, and I adored her. And these are, as educators, your governor and Mrs. Walls, both, these are matters that are close to their heart. And they look to serve the families and the children and get them where they're going to be in life. So, you know, Minnesota's ahead of the game, but the cuts, look, you're going to get penalized going to get penalized because whatever party you are, which this is crazy town. That's nuts to me. And I don't talk politics. I talk common sense. By the way, very thrilled about the war in the Middle East seeming to come to a close. I pray that that is the case. And I give my full support to those who are doing that. So, we should be grateful when we need to be, and we should stand up and fight for our rights when we feel our rights are being misplaced. I think this is that iron range common sense. That's my mother coming through me from heaven.
So let's talk about the new book, because Heidi and I both read it, The View from Lake Como, which takes place in two places, Lake Como, New Jersey, and Lake Como in Italy. So is Lake Como, New Jersey, that is a real place?
Yes, and it is my historical backdrop for the novel, because when you write a novel, you must have, it seems to me, historical scope. The story has to take place in a moment in time, because that then serves the story. It's like, to make it simple, a disco ball, a novel, that every single storyline in that novel has to sort of refract from the same mirror, has to be part of the whole circle. Okay, so in all my novels, if you look, you know, I just mentioned World War One, sometimes World War Two, sometimes it's the end of a post-war era, sometimes the 1970s, sometimes it's 1980s. It just depends. But I had gone to a wedding with my husband in New Jersey in this incredible cathedral church that had been every drop of marble in there had come from Italy, Carrara. So I, over a process of many years, I take notes, I return there. And I said, let's just drive around. I want to get my bearings. And so between South Belmar and Spring Lake, there was a little town called there's Belmar, then South Belmar, then Spring Lake. And South Belmar is like a little town between with a lake called Lake Como and the ocean. And at the turn of this century, it was in trouble. As South Belmar is kind of a dumping ground. People were like throwing trash out their windows. You know how that is. You know the town where you do that. Well, that was intriguing to me. And then I discovered that they changed the name to Lake Como and their property values went up. So I thought, what a perfect backdrop for a woman who's falling apart and has to put herself back together. So that's where that came from. But it's true. 2005, they changed the name.
I didn't realize it was that recent in the name change. But about the mining, the marble is sort of a character in this book. It is very much, it's her job. It's her connection to her uncle. It's the connection to Italy. So is that church the origin of like that church made of marble? Is that where the inspiration came from to kind of?
That's where the inspiration came from. Yeah. And the way I work is then I spend time reading and I go to the places and I talk to people and I learn, because obviously I'm not a draftsman. But when I start to learn something, again, I go back to that refractory where it's like, oh, well, that led to that, which led to that, which led to that. So there's a real strong sense that the craft of something, and I don't know about your families. I'm getting a sense you're Minnesotan. So there was farming and mining in there, right? Mm-hmm. Teaching probably in some of your families. Okay. So this is how we built America. We built our communities as we survived by the labor of our own hands. So I was incredibly interested in that in terms of marble. But of course, you know, nothing is as it seems. You know, you have marble in your bathroom, you probably don't think about where it came from too much, but I have to know because I'm going to write about it, right? And then I love the idea when I was there in Italy, an old man said to me, you'll be gone, generations after you will be gone, but the marble will remain. The marble that you cut from the mountain in Carrara today is the same mine matrix of mines at the top of the mountain where Michelangelo went to get his marble to carve the David. Hmm. So you are standing really on hallowed ground.
Yeah. Another big part of this book is about self-discovery and change. And, you know, your main character just goes through a divorce and is just kind of feeling at the beginning of the book like she doesn't know who she is yet.
That's right. That's right. And she's actually doing online therapy, which I have a podcast, You Are What You Read, and I did advertising for online therapy. They gave me a free one, and that had me look into that. And I thought to make it hilarious, you'd get a different doctor each time. You just put you know, so you had Dr. Raymond, you tell him your problems. Well, then the next one comes up, it's Dr. Barbara. I mean, it just keeps rolling out. And that made me laugh. And then I went, how am I going to pull her out of this? Because it had to be organic. But I feel that, you know, like when we have children, we go, you ask any parent on the planet. Are you both parents?
I am.
Yeah, I'm not. Yeah.
Yeah, okay, you will be, because everybody mothers everybody. You'll see.
Right, yeah, that's true.
Somebody's going to end up living with you when they're 14, and yep. You're gonna be like, I got a kid
yeah,
now.
Sure, I've had that, sure.
Okay, well, there you go.
Yeah.
Okay, so I always say this to every woman I meet, when they say I don't have children. Yeah, you do. Yeah, you do. Because I've relied on you raising my one, too, with my husband. But what the essence is of what we want for our children is we want them to be happy. I just want him or her to be happy. Well, as adults, we know that this is a con. There are moments of wonderful contentment. I happen to think the more you're laughing, the happier your life will be. But happy is a word that gets us tripped up. She knows she's not where she's supposed to be with, who she's supposed to be with, doing what she's supposed to be doing. That's your trifecta there. Love, work, relationships. So in that trifecta, she's failing on all fronts. She has a family that has not been transparent with her, but she loves them. And I didn't want this to be one of those novels where she ends up putting her family, not speaking to them for years and putting them on the island.
Putting them on the island, yeah.
If anybody's been in that situation with a friend or a family member, it's torture, okay? And I don't like that. So I thought, how am I going to solve that for the reader, to encourage the reader to do right by herself, you know? So now you're seeing this character, Giuseppina Capodimonte Barada, taking shape. And you might say to me, well, Adriana, where'd you get her? I mean, she just walked in the room, and she kind of did. But in this way, I had written The Good Left Undone, and it's a big, luscious historical. And I looked around the world, and people were really upset, and they're sad, and they're worried, and there's anxiety. And in those moments, that's when you really need comedy. And I said, I'm going to write a contemporary comedy. So that's how I did it. I look at what I think you need from me, and then I write what I think is going to lift you out of this funk, or going to entertain, delight you, or inform you, or whatever it would happen to be, right? So with this and this character, she had